You said that you found a fingerprint at Jess Ogilvie's house in the kitchen that belongs to Jacob. That's right. Can you say that the presence of that fingerprint identifies him as a murderer? No. It only places him at the scene of the crime. Is it possible that Jacob might have left the fingerprint there at some other point? Yes. You also found Mark McGuire's boot prints beneath a window sash that had been jimmied and cut, I say. Is that correct? Yes, we did. Did you find Jacob's boot prints anywhere outside? No, Marcy says. I take a deep breath. I hope you know what you're doing, I think silently, looking back once at Jacob. And the blood in the bathroom, were you able to determine whether it belonged to the victim? No. We tried to run a DNA test, but the results were not conclusive. There were traces of bleach in the swabs, and bleach often compromises DNA tests. Isn't it true, Ms. Alston, that when sprayed on bleach, luminol also gives a positive reading? Yes, sometimes. So the traces of blood you found might be traces of bleach instead. It's possible, she concedes. And the alleged blood in the bathroom might simply have been Jess cleaning the tile floor with Clorox. Or, Marcy says, your client cleaning blood off the tile floor with Clorox after he murdered her. I wince and immediately back off. Ms. Alston, you can tell a lot about a body from the way that person is positioned at death, can't you? Yes. Was there anything that struck you about Jess Ogilvie's body when it was found? Marcy hesitates. She wasn't discarded. Someone had taken the time to sit her upright and to wrap her in a quilt instead of dumping her. Someone who cared for her. Objection, Helen interrupts, and like I expect, it's sustained by the judge. Do you know my client, Ms. Alston? Actually, I do. How? He's a crime scene junkie. He's been at a few I've been called to, and he starts giving us advice we don't particularly want or need. Have you ever let him help out at a crime scene? Absolutely not. But it's pretty clear he's fascinated by all that stuff. She shakes her head. Only two kinds of people show up at crime scenes. The serial killers who are checking their handiwork, and the crazies who think police work is like the television shows and want to help solve the crime. Great. Now she's got the jury wondering which of those two categories Jacob fits. I decide to cut my losses before I completely implode. Nothing further, I say, and Helen gets up to redirect. Ms. Alston, did Jacob Hunt show up at the culvert when you were processing the body? No, she says. We didn't see him at all. Helen shrugs. I guess this time there was nothing for him to solve.
Jacob. If I don't become a crime scene investigator famous in my field like Dr. Henry Lee, I'm going to become a medical examiner. It's the same work, really, except that your canvas is smaller. Instead of processing an entire house or a stretch of woods to determine the story of the crime, you coax the story out of the dead person on your autopsy table. There are many things that make dead bodies preferable to live ones. One, they don't have facial expressions, so there's no worry about mistaking a smile for a smirk or any of that nonsense. Two, they don't get bored if you're hogging the conversation. Three, they don't care if you stand too close or too far away. Four, they don't talk about you when you leave the room or tell their friends how annoying you are. You can tell from a dead body the sequence of events that occurred. If the abdominal gunshot wound caused the peritonitis and septicemia, if those complications were the cause of death, or if it was the respiratory distress syndrome they led to that was the final blow. You can tell if the person died in a field or was left in the trunk of a car. You can tell if a person's been shot in the head before the body was set on fire, or vice versa. When the skull is removed, you can see the blood that has started seeping as a result of the brain being boiled, a thermal injury. If you don't see that, it usually means the execution was the cause of death, not the fire. Admit it, you wanted to know. For all these reasons, I'm very attentive when Dr. Wayne Nussbaum takes the stand to testify. I know him. I've seen him before at crime scenes. Once, I wrote him a letter and got his autograph. He lists his credentials: Yale University Medical School, followed by rotations in pathology and emergency medicine before becoming an assistant medical examiner for the state of New York, and finally, 20 years as chief medical examiner in Vermont. "Did you perform an autopsy on Jess Ogilvy?" asked Helen Sharp.
"I did. On the afternoon of January 18th, he said. The body was brought to my office in the morning, but had to thaw.
What was the temperature outside when she was found?
12 degrees, which allowed for excellent preservation.
How was she dressed?
She was wearing sweatpants and a t-shirt and a light jacket. She was not wearing a bra. Her underwear was on backward. There was a tooth wrapped in toilet paper in a small front pocket of the sweatpants, and her cell phone was zipped into the pocket of her jacket.
Usually on Crime Busters, when a medical examiner takes the stand, it's a 5-minute testimony, tops. Helen Sharp, however, walks Dr. Nussbaum through his findings 3 times, once verbally, a second time with a diagram of a body while Dr. Nussbaum draws his findings in red marker, and finally with photographs he'd taken during the autopsy. Me, I'm loving every minute. I don't know about that lady on the jury, though, who looks like she's about to throw up. You said, doctor, that you took samples of Jess Ogilvy's urine, heart blood, and vitreous humor from her eyes for toxicology purposes.
That's correct.
What's the purpose of those exams?
They let us know what foreign substances are in the victim's bloodstream. In the case of the heart blood and the vitreous humor, it's at the time of death.
What were the results?
Jessica Ogilvy did not have any drugs or alcohol in her system at the time of death.
Did you take photographs of the body during the autopsy?
Yes, he says. It's routine procedure.
Did you make any notations as to unusual marks or bruises on the body?
Yes. The victim had bruises on her throat consistent with choking, and bruises on her arms consistent with being restrained. The bruises were reddish-violet and had sharp edges, which suggested that they occurred within 24 hours of death. In addition, the skin on her lower back had been scraped post-mortem, most likely as a result of being dragged. You can see the difference in the photograph here between the two sorts of bruises. The post-mortem one is yellowish and leathery.
He pointed to another photograph, this one of Jess's face.
The victim was badly beaten. She had suffered a basal skull fracture, bruises around the eyes, and a broken nose. She was missing a front tooth.
Were you able to tell if those injuries were pre- or post-mortem?
The fact that bruising occurred indicates the injury was prior to death. The tooth, well, that I can't say for sure, but it did seem to be the one tucked in her pocket.
Can you punch someone so hard in the face that they lose a tooth?
Yes, it's possible, Dr. Nussbaum says.
Would someone who had been punched hard in the face present with the same sorts of injuries you found on the victim's body?
Yes.
Doctor, Helen Sharp asks, after having done the autopsy and studied the results from the toxicology labs, did you form an opinion within a reasonable degree of medical certainty about the manner of death?
Yes. I ruled it a homicide.
What was the cause of Jess Ogilvy's death?
Blunt head trauma, which led to subdural hematoma, bleeding inside the skull, consistent with a blow or a fall.
How long does it take to die from a subdural hematoma?
It can be immediate, or it can take hours. In the victim's case, It was relatively soon after injury.
Did the bruises you found on Jess Ogilvie's neck and arms contribute to her death?
No.
How about the tooth that was knocked out?
No.
And there were no drugs or alcohol in her system?
No, there were not.
So, Dr. Nussbaum, Helen Sharp says, the sole cause of fatal injury to Jess Ogilvie that you found during the autopsy was a basal skull fracture that caused internal bleeding in the skull?
That's correct.
Your witness, the prosecutor says, and Oliver stands up. All those injuries you found on Jess Ogilvie's body, he says. You have any idea what caused them?
No.
And you said that a subdural hematoma could be caused by either a blow or a fall?
Correct.
Isn't it possible, doctor, Oliver asks, that Jess Ogilvie tripped and fell and suffered a subdural hematoma? The medical examiner looks up and smiles a little. It's one of those smiles I hate, the kind that might mean you are so smart, but might also mean you moron.
It's possible Jess Ogilvie tripped and fell and suffered a subdural hematoma, Dr. Nussbaum says. But I highly doubt that she tried to strangle herself, or knocked out her own tooth, or put on her underwear backward, dragged herself 300 yards away, and wrapped herself in a quilt in a culvert.
I laugh out loud. That's such a great line, it might have been scripted for Crime Busters. My mother and Oliver look at me, and that expression's easy to read. They're both 100% pissed off.
Perhaps now's a good time for a serenity break, the judge asks.
Sensory, Oliver snaps. It's a sensory break.
Judge Cuttings clears his throat. I'll take that as a yes.
In the sensory break room, I lie underneath the weighted blanket. My mother's in the bathroom. Theo has his head on the vibrating pillow. He talks through his teeth and sounds like a robot.
Tickle me, Elmo, he says.
Jacob, Oliver says after a minute and 33 seconds of silence. Your behavior in this courtroom is making me very angry. Well, your behavior in this courtroom is making me very angry, I say. You still haven't told them the truth. You know it's not our turn yet. You've seen trials on television. The prosecution goes first, and then we get to undo the damage Helen Sharp's done. But Jacob, Jesus, every time you have an outburst or you laugh at something a witness says, that adds to the damage. He looks at me. Imagine you're a juror, and you've got a daughter about Jess's age. And then the defendant laughs out loud when the medical examiner talks about the gruesome way Jess died. What do you think that juror is saying to himself?
I'm not a juror, I say, so I don't really know. What the medical examiner said at the end was pretty amusing, Theo adds.
Oliver frowns at him. Did I ask you for your opinion?
Did Jacob ask you for yours? Theo says, and then he tosses me the pillow.
Don't listen to him, Theo tells me, and he slips out of the sensory break room. I find Oliver staring at me. Do you miss Jess?
Yes. She was my friend.
Then why don't you show it?
Why should I?
I ask, sitting up. If I know I feel it, that's what counts. Don't you ever look at someone who's hysterical in public and wonder if it's because they really feel miserable or because they want others to know they're miserable? It kind of dilutes the emotion if you display it for the whole world to see. Makes it less pure.
Well, that's not how the majority of people think. Most people, confronted with photographic evidence of the autopsy of someone they loved, would get upset. Maybe even cry.
Cry? Are you kidding? I mimic a phrase I've heard kids say at school. I would have killed to be at that autopsy. Oliver turns away.
I'm pretty sure I hear him wrong.
Did you?
Rich. The running joke among those of us sequestered for the trial involves the sensory break room. If the defendant can get some special accommodation, why not the witnesses? Me? I want a Chinese food takeout room. I tell this to Helen Sharp when she comes to let me know that I'm testifying next. Dumplings, I say, have been scientifically proven to enhance witness focus. And General So's chicken clogs the arteries just enough to increase blood flow to the brain. And here all this time I thought your disability was your short, hey, attention span, Helen says. She smiles at me. You have 5 minutes.
I'm only half kidding. I mean, if the court was willing to bend over backward for Jacob Hunt's Asperger's syndrome, how long will it be before this is used as a precedent by some career criminal who insists that going to jail will inflame his claustrophobia? I'm all for equality, but not when it erodes the system. I decide to take a leak before court reconvenes and have just turned the corner toward the hallway where the restrooms are located, when I smack directly into a woman who's walking in the opposite direction. Whoa, I say, steadying her. I'm sorry. Emma Hunt looks up at me with those incredible eyes of hers.
I bet, she says.
In another lifetime, if I had another job and she had a different kid, maybe we would have been talking over a bottle of wine. Maybe she would be smiling at me instead of looking like she's just been confronted by her worst nightmare. How are you holding up?
You have no right to ask me that.
She tries to push past me, but I block her with an outstretched arm. I'm just doing my job, Emma.
I have to get back to Jacob.
Look, I'm sorry this happened to you, because you've already had to go through a lot. But the day Jess died, a mother lost her child.
And now, she says, you're going to make me lose mine.
She pushes at my arm. This time I let her go. It takes 10 minutes for Helen to walk me through my credentials. My rank as captain, my training as detective in Townsend, the fact that I've been doing this since before Jesus was born, yada yada, all the stuff a jury wants to hear to know they're in good hands.
How did you become involved in the investigation into Jess Ogilvie's death? Helen begins.
Her boyfriend, Mark McGuire, came to the police station and reported her missing on January 13th. He hadn't seen her since the morning of the 12th and had been unable to make contact with her. She had no planned trips, and her friends and parents did not know where she was either. Her purse and coat were at her house, but other personal items were missing.
Such as?
Her toothbrush, her cell phone. I glance at Jacob, who raises his brows expectantly. And some clothes in a backpack. I finish, and he smiles and ducks his head, nodding.
What did you do?
I went with Mr. McGuire to the house and listed the items that were missing. I also took a typed note found in the mailbox, asking for the mail to be held, and sent it to the lab for fingerprints. Then I told Mr. McGuire that we'd have to wait and see if Miss Ogilvie returned.
Why did you send the note to the lab? Helen asks.
Because it seems strange to type a note to your mailman.
Did you get results back from the laboratory?
Yes, they were inconclusive. No fingerprints were found on the paper. That led me to believe that it was possibly a note typed by someone smart enough to wear gloves when placing it. A red herring to make us think Jess had run away on her own.
What happened next?
I received a call from Mr. McGuire a day later, saying that a rack of CDs had been knocked over and then alphabetized. It didn't seem to be a clear sign of foul play. After all, this was something that Jess might have done, and in my experience, felons don't tend to be neat freaks. However, we formally opened an investigation into Miss Ogilvie's disappearance. A CSI team was dispatched to her residence to gather evidence. I took her date book from her purse, which was found in the kitchen, and began to follow up on the meetings she had prior to her disappearance and was scheduled to have afterward.
Did you attempt to contact Jess Ogilvie during this investigation?
Numerous times. We called her cell phone, but it went right into her voicemail, until even that was full. With the help of the FBI, we attempted to ping her cell phone.
What does that mean?
Using a GPS locator built into the device, the FBI has a software program which can find coordinates within a meter of actual physical location anywhere in the world. But in this case, the results were inconclusive. The phone has to be powered up in order for the software to work, and apparently Jess Ogilvie's was not, I say. We also screened the messages that came into her residence. One was from Mr. McGuire, one was from a vendor, one from the defendant's mother, and three were missed calls that originated from Jess Ogilvie's own cell phone number. Based on the timestamps of the answering machine, it suggested that Miss Ogilvie was still alive somewhere at the time the calls were placed, or that we were being led to believe this by whoever had her cell phone.
Detective, when did you first meet the defendant?
On January 15th.
Had you seen him before?
Yes, at a crime scene a week earlier. He crashed an investigation.
Where did you meet Mr. Hunt on January 15th?
At his house.
Who else was present?
His mother.
Did you take the defendant into custody at that time?
No, he wasn't a suspect. I asked him questions about his appointment with Jess. He said that he'd gone to her house for the 2:35 appointment, but did not meet with her. He indicated that he walked home. He also revealed that Mark McGuire was not present when he arrived at Miss Ogilvie's place. When I asked him whether he had seen Jess fight with her boyfriend, he said, "Hasta la vista, baby."
Did you recognize that statement?
I believe it's attributed to the governor of California, I say, before he entered politics.
Did you ask the defendant anything else at that meeting?
No, I was dismissed. It was 4:30, and at 4:30 he watches a television show.
Did you see the defendant again?
Yes. I received a call from Emma Hunt, his mother, indicating that Jacob had something else to tell me.
What did Jacob say during that second conversation?
He presented me with Jess Ogilvie's missing backpack and some of her clothing. He admitted that he had gone to her house and found signs of a struggle, which he cleaned up.
Cleaned up?
Yes, he righted stools and picked up the mail, which had been thrown on the floor, and restacked the CDs and alphabetized them. He took the backpack because he thought she might need it. He then proceeded to show me the backpack and the items inside.
Did you take Jacob into custody at that time?
I did not.
Did you take the clothes and backpack with you?
Yes. We tested them and the results were negative. There were no prints, no blood, no DNA.
Then what happened? Helen asks.
I met the CSI team at Jess Ogilvie's home. They had found trace evidence of blood in the bathroom, and a cut screen in the kitchen window, as well as a broken window sash. They also found a boot print outside the house that seemed to match the boots worn by Mark McGuire.
What happened after that?
I faced the jury. Early Monday morning, January 18th, shortly after 3 a.m., Townsend Dispatch received a 911 call. All 911 calls are traced through GPS technology, so responders can reach whoever is making the call. This call originated from a culvert approximately 300 yards from the home where Jess Ogilvie was residing. I responded to the call. The victim's body and her phone were found there, and she was wrapped in a blanket. There's a video clip from the midday news that aired on WCAX. I hesitate, waiting for Helen to take the tape and enter it as evidence, to pull the television monitor closer to the jury so that they can see it. There is utter silence as the reporter's face fills the screen, her eyes watering in the cold, while crime scene investigators move along behind her. The reporter shifts her feet, and Helen freezes the image.
Do you recognize that blanket, Detective? she asks. It's a multicolored quilt, definitely hand-sewn. Yes, it was wrapped around Jess Ogilvy's body. Is this the same blanket? She holds up the quilt, with its blood stains ruining the pattern here and there. That's it, I say.
What happened after that?
With the discovery of the body, I had several officers arrest Mark McGuire for the murder of Jess Ogilvy. I was interrogating him when I received another call.
Did the caller identify him or herself?
Yes, it was Jacob Hunt's mother, Emma.
What was her demeanor?
Helen asks. She was frantic, extremely upset.
What did she tell you?
The other lawyer, the one who looks like he's still in high school, objects. That's hearsay, Your Honor, he says. Counsel, approach, the judge says. Helen speaks quietly.
Judge, I would make an offer of proof that the mother called because she had just seen the news clip with that quilt on the screen and was able to link it to her son. Therefore, Your Honor, it's an excited utterance.
The objection's overruled, the judge says, and Helen approaches me again.
What did the defendant's mother tell you? She repeats.
I don't want to look at Emma. I can already feel the heat of her gaze, the accusations. She told me that the quilt belonged to her son.
Based on the results of your conversation, what did you do?
I asked Miss Hunt to bring Jacob down to the station so that we could speak further.
Did you place Jacob Hunt under arrest for the murder of Jess Ogilvy?
Yes.
Then what happened?
I dismissed all charges against Mr. McGuire. I also executed a search warrant for the defendant's house.
What did you find there?
We found Jacob Hunt's police scanner, a self-constructed fuming chamber for fingerprinting, and hundreds of black-and-white composition notebooks.
What was in those notebooks?
Jacob used them to record information about Crime Busters episodes he watched. He'd write down the date the episode aired, and the evidence, and then whether or not he solved the crime before the television detectives did. I saw him writing in one the first time I came to his house to speak to him.
How many did you find?
116. The prosecutor enters one into evidence.
Do you recognize this, Detective Mattson?
It's one of those notebooks, the one with the most recent entries.
Can you turn to the 14th page of this notebook and tell us what you find there?
I read aloud the subject heading. At her house, 1-12-10. Situation. Girl reported missing by her boyfriend. Evidence. Clothes in pile on bed. Toothbrush missing. Lip gloss missing. Victim's purse and coat remain. Cell phone missing. Luminol bathroom, blood detected. Knapsack taken with clothing and mailbox note. Red herring for kidnapping. Cut screen. Boot prints outside match up with boyfriend's footwear. Cell phone traced by 911 call to location of body in culvert.
Is there anything intriguing about this entry in particular?
I don't know if it's a Crime Busters episode, but it's the exact crime scene we found at Jess Ogilvy's residence. It's the exact way we found Jess Ogilvy's body, and all this information is information nobody should have had, I say, except for the police and the killer.
Oliver. I knew that Jacob was going to have trouble when those journals were presented as evidence. I wouldn't want the equivalent of my diary being read to a jury. Not that I keep a diary, or not that I would recount the evidence at a murder scene in one. So, I am expecting it when he starts rocking a little bit as Helen enters the journal into evidence. I can feel the stiffening of his spine, the way he is breathing hard, the fact that he barely blinks. When Jacob leans toward the table, I meet Emma's gaze over his head. Now, she mouths, and sure enough, Jacob shoves a piece of paper into my hands. F sharp, it reads. It takes me a moment to realize that he's passed me a note, just like I told him to do if he needed a sensory break. Your Honor, I say, standing up.
Could we take a short recess?
We just had a recess, Mr. Bond, Judge Cutting says, and then he looks at Jacob, whose face is bright red. 5 minutes, he announces. With me on one side and Emma locked on the other, we hustle Jacob up the aisle to the sensory break room.
Just hold it together for another 30 seconds, Emma soothes. 10 more steps. 9, 8.
Jacob ducks inside and spins around to face us.
Oh my God, he shrieks, a smile splitting his face. Wasn't that awesome?
I just stare at him.
I mean, that was the whole point. They finally got it. I set up a crime scene and the cops figured the whole thing out, even the red herrings.
He pokes me in the chest with his finger.
You, Jacob says, are doing a great job.
Behind me, Emma bursts into tears. I don't look at her. I can't.
I'll fix it, I say.
There is a moment when I stand up to do the cross-examination of Detective Mattson that I think we might have a pissing contest instead. He takes a look at Emma, her eyes still red, her face still puffy, and narrows his gaze at me, as if her condition is my fault instead of his. And that only makes me want to sink him even more.
The first time you met with Jacob at his house, Detective, I begin, he quoted the movie Terminator to you, correct?
Yes.
And the second time you met with Jacob, he recommended a variety of tests for you to run on the backpack.
Yes.
How many?
Several.
I grab the legal pad that's in front of Jacob. Did he recommend a DNA test on the straps of the backpack?
Yes.
And an AP test on the underwear inside?
I guess.
Luminol?
That sounds about right.
And what about ninhydrin on the card inside?
Look, I don't remember them all, but that's probably true.
In fact, Detective, I say, Jacob seemed to know your job better than you do.
He narrows his eyes. He certainly knew the crime scene better than I did.
Those composition notebooks that you found, did you read them all?
Yes.
What did the other 115 notebooks contain?
Synopses, he says, of episodes of Crime Busters.
Do you know what Crime Busters is, Detective?
I think you'd have to be living under a rock to not know, he says. It's a police procedural television show that's probably syndicated on Mars by now.
You ever watch it?
He laughs. I try not to. It's not exactly realistic.
So the cases aren't true crime?
No.
Then is it fair to say that the 116 journals you seized from Jacob's room are full of descriptions of fictional crime scenes?
Well, yes, Mattson says. But I don't think the one he wrote in the 116th journal was fictional at all.
How do you know? I take a few steps toward him. In fact, Detective, there was media coverage of Jess Ogilvie's disappearance before you got hold of this notebook, wasn't there?
Yes. Her name was on the news. Her parents were asking for help solving the crime.
Yes. You testified that Jacob would show up at crime scenes looking to help, correct?
Yes, but...
Did he ever offer up information that was surprising to you?
Mattson hesitates. Yes.
So, isn't it possible, especially given that he knew this particular victim, that he wasn't using the notebook to brag about a murder, but rather, like he did with every Crime Busters episode, using it to help solve the case? I turn to the jury before he can even answer. Nothing further, I say.
Helen stands up at the prosecutor's table.
Detective Mattson, she says, can you read the notation at the bottom of the first page of the notebook?
It says, solved, me, 24 minutes.
What about the notation at the bottom of the entry on page 6?
Solved, them, 55 minutes, good one.
She walks toward Mattson. Do you have any idea what that notation indicates?
Jacob told me when I first saw him writing in the journals, He marks down whether he solved the crime before the TV detectives did, and how long it took. "Detective," Helen says, "can you read the notation at the bottom of page 14, the entry entitled, At Her House, that you read for us earlier?" He glances down at the page. "It says, Solved Me." "Anything else notable about that line?" Mattson looks at the jury. "It's underlined 10 times.
Theo. At dinner, I'm the one who sees my brother stealing the knife. I don't say anything at first, but it's perfectly clear to me the way he pauses in the middle of his yellow rice and scrambled eggs to carve the kernels off an ear of corn, and then pushes the knife with his thumbs to the edge of the table so that it falls into his lap. My mother yammers on about the trial, about the coffee machine at the courthouse which only dispenses cold coffee, about what Jacob is going to wear tomorrow, about the defense which will present its case in the morning. I don't think either of us is listening, because Jacob is trying to not move his shoulders while he wraps the knife in a napkin, and I'm trying to study his every move. When he starts to get up from the table and my mother cuts him off with a sharp, forced cough, I'm sure she's going to call him on his stolen cutlery. But instead, she says, 'Aren't you forgetting something?' 'May I be excused?' Jacob mutters. And a minute later, he's scraped his plate and heads upstairs. 'I wonder what's the matter,' my mother says. 'He hardly ate.' I shovel the rest of my food into my mouth and then mumble a request to be excused. I hurry upstairs, but Jacob's not in his room. The bathroom door is wide open, too. It's like he's just vanished. I walk into my own bedroom, and all of a sudden I'm grabbed and pulled against the wall, and there's a knife at my throat. Okay, I'm just going to say it's pretty depressing that this is not the first time I've found myself in this scenario with my brother. I do what I know works. I bite his wrist. You'd think he'd see it coming, but he doesn't. The knife clatters to the floor, and I elbow him in his soft gut. He doubles over, grunting. 'What the fuck are you doing?' I yell. 'Practicing?' I reach for the knife and stick it inside my desk drawer, the one I keep locked, where I've learned to keep the things I don't want Jacob to get. 'Practicing murder?' I say. 'You crazy motherfucker, this is why you're going to get convicted.' 'I wasn't going to actually hurt you.' Jacob sits down heavily on my bed. 'There was someone looking at me funny today.' 'I'd think a lot of people in that courtroom were looking at you funny. But this one guy followed me to the bathroom. I have to be able to protect myself.' 'Right. And what do you think is going to happen tomorrow morning, when you walk into the courthouse and the metal detectors start beeping, and the stupid reporters all watch you pull a steak knife out of your sock?' He frowns. This is one of those harebrained Aspie schemes of his, the ones he never thinks through. Like when he called the cops on my mom 2 months ago. To Jacob, I'm sure it seemed perfectly logical. To the rest of the free world, not so much. 'What if there's nothing wrong with me?' Jacob says. 'What if the reason I act like I do and think like I do is that I'm left out all the time? If I had friends, you know, maybe I wouldn't do things that look strange to everyone else. It's like bacteria that only grows in a vacuum. Maybe there's no such thing as Asperger's. Maybe all there is what happens to you when you don't fit in.' 'Don't go telling your lawyer that. He needs Asperger's to exist big time right now.' I look at Jacob's hands. His cuticles are bitten down to the skin. Often he draws blood. My mother used to have to wrap band-aids around all his fingers before she sent him to school. Once in the hallways, I heard two girls calling him the mummy. 'Hey, Jacob,' I say quietly. I'll tell you something no one else knows. His hand flutters on his thigh.
A secret?
Yeah. But you can't tell Mom. I want to tell him. I've wanted to tell someone for so long now. But maybe Jacob is right. In the absence of having space in the world, the thing that's left behind just gets bigger and more unrecognizable. It swells in my throat. It steals all the air in the room, and suddenly I'm blubbering like a baby. I'm wiping my eyes with my sleeves and trying to pretend that my brother isn't in court, my brother isn't going to jail, that this isn't karmic payment for all the bad things I've done and all the bad thoughts I've had. I was there, I blurt out. I was there the day Jess died. Jacob doesn't look at me. And maybe that's easier. He flutters his hand a little faster and then brings it up to his throat. I know, he says. My eyes widen.
You do?
Of course I do. I saw your footprints. He stares just over my shoulder. That's why I had to do it. Oh my God. She told Jacob that I'd been spying on her naked and that she was going to go to the cops, and he shut her up. Now I'm sobbing. I can barely catch my breath. I'm sorry. He doesn't touch me or hug me or comfort me the way my mom would, the way any other human would. Jacob just keeps fanning his fingers. And then he says, I'm sorry, I'm sorry. Like I did, an echo that's been stripped of its music, like rain on tin. It's prosody. It's part of Asperger's. When Jacob was little, he would repeat questions I asked and throw them back at me like a baseball pitch, instead of answering. My mother told me this was like his movie quotes, a verbal stim. It was Jacob's way of feeling the words in his mouth when he had nothing to say in return. But all the same, I let myself pretend it's his robotic, monotone way of asking for my forgiveness, too.
Jacob. That day when we come home from court, instead of watching Crime Busters, I choose a different video instead. It's a home movie of me when I was a baby, only 1 year old. It must be my birthday because there's a cake, and I'm clapping and smiling and saying things like mama and dada and milk. Every time someone says my name, I look up, right into the camera. I look normal. My parents are happy. My dad's there, and he's not even in any videos we have of Theo. My mother doesn't have the line between her eyes that she has now. Most people take home movies, after all, to capture something they want to remember, not a moment they'd rather forget. That's not the case later on in the video. All of a sudden, instead of sticking my fingers in a cake and offering up a big gummy smile, I'm rocking in front of the washing machine, watching the clothes turn in circles. I'm lying in front of the television, but instead of watching the programming, I'm lining up Lego pieces end to end. My father isn't in the film anymore. Instead, there are people I don't know. A woman with frizzy yellow hair and a sweatshirt with a cat on it, who gets down on the floor with me and moves my head so that I focus on a puzzle she set down. A lady with bright blue eyes is having a conversation with me, if you can call it that. Lady. Jacob, are you excited about going to the circus? Me.
Yes.
Lady. What do you want to see at the circus? Me. No answer. Lady. Say, at the circus, I want to see... Me.
I want to see clowns.
Lady. Gives me an M&M.
I love clowns.
Are you excited about the circus? Me.
Yeah, I want to see clowns.
Lady gives me 3 M&Ms.
Jacob, that's great.
Me. I stuff the M&Ms into my mouth. These are the movies my mother took as evidence, as proof that I was now a different child than the one she'd started with. I don't know what she was thinking when she recorded them. Surely she didn't want to sit and watch all this over and over, the visual equivalent of a slap in the face. Maybe she was keeping them in the hope that one day a pharmaceutical executive might arrive unexpectedly for dinner, watch the tapes, and cut her a check for damages. As I'm watching, there's a sudden streak of silver static that makes me cover my ears. And then there's another segment of video. It's been accidentally taped over my Oscar-worthy autistic toddler film, and in it, I'm much older. It's only a year ago. And I'm getting ready for my junior prom. Jess took the video. She came over that afternoon while I was getting ready, so that she could see the final result of our preparations. I can hear her voice. Jacob, she says, for God's sake, get closer to her. She's not going to bite you. The video swings like an amusement park ride, and I hear Jess's voice again. Oops, I suck at this. My mother has a camera and is taking a picture of me with my date. The girl's name is Amanda, and she goes to my school. She's wearing an orange dress, which is probably the reason I refuse to get closer to her, even though I usually do what Jess wants. On television, it's like I'm watching a make-believe show, and Jacob isn't me, he's a character. It's not really me who closes his eyes when my mother tries to take a picture on the front lawn. It's not really me who walks to Amanda's car and sits in the back like I always do.
Oh, no,
my mother's voice says, and Jess starts laughing.
We totally forgot about that, she says.
Suddenly, the camera turns around fast, and Jess's face is fishbowl close.
Hello, world,
she says, and she pretends to swallow the camera. She's smiling. Then there's a line of red that moves down the television screen like a curtain, and suddenly I'm only 3 years old again, and I'm stacking a green block on top of a blue block on top of a yellow block, just like the therapist has shown me.
Jacob, good work,
she says, and she pushes a toy truck toward me as a reward. I flip it over and spin its wheels. I want Jess to be on screen again.
I wish I knew how to quit you,
I whisper. Suddenly, my chest feels like it's shrinking, the way it sometimes does when I'm standing with a group of kids in school, and I realize I'm the only one who didn't get the punchline of the joke. Or that I am the punchline of the joke. I start to think maybe I've done something wrong. Really wrong. Because I don't know how to fix it, I pick up the remote control and rewind the tape almost back to the beginning, to the time when I was no different from anyone else.
This ends Disc 14. House Rules, Disc 15.
Emma. From Auntie M's Archives. Dear Auntie M, how do I get a boy's attention? I'm hopeless at flirting, and there are so many other girls out there who are prettier and smarter than I am, but I'm sick of never being noticed. Maybe I can reinvent myself. What can I do? Baffled in Bennington. Dear Baffled, you don't have to be anyone except who you already are. You just have to get a guy to take a second look. For this, there are 2 approaches. 1. Stop waiting. Take the initiative and go talk to him. Ask him if he got the answer to number 7 on your math homework. Tell him he did a great job in the school talent show. 2. Start walking around naked. But it's your choice. Love, Auntie M. When I can't sleep, I pull a cardigan over my pajamas and sit outside on the porch steps and try to imagine the life I might have had. Henry and I would be waiting with Jacob for college acceptance letters. We might pop out a bottle of champagne and let him have a glass to celebrate once he made his choice. Theo wouldn't hole himself up in his room, doing his absolute best to pretend he doesn't belong to this family. Instead, he would sit at the kitchen table, doing crosswords in the daily paper. "Three letters," he'd say, and he'd read the clue. "Hope was often found here." And we'd all guess at the answer. God? Sky? Arkansas? But Jacob would be the one to get it right. USO. Our boys would be listed on the honor roll quarterly, and people would stare at me when I went shopping for groceries. Not because I was the mother of that autistic boy, or worse, the murderer, but because they wished they were as lucky as me. I don't believe in self-pity. I think it's for people who have too much time on their hands. Instead of dreaming of a miracle, you learn to make your own. But the universe has a way of punishing you for your deepest, darkest secrets. And as much as I love my son, as much as Jacob has been the star around which I've orbited, I've had my share of moments when I silently imagined the person I was supposed to be. The one who got lost, somehow, in the daily business of raising an autistic child. Be careful what you wish for. Picture your life without Jacob, and it just may come true. I listened to the testimony today. And yes, as Oliver has said, it's not our turn yet. But I watched the faces of the jury as they stared at Jacob, and I saw the same expression I've seen 1,000 times before. That mental distancing, that subtle acknowledgement that there is something wrong with that boy. Because he doesn't interact the way they do. Because he doesn't grieve the way they do. Because he doesn't move or speak the way they do. I fought so hard to have Jacob mainstreamed at school. Not just so that he could see the way other kids behaved, but because other kids needed to see him, and to learn that different isn't synonymous with bad. But I can't say, honestly, that his classmates ever learned that lesson. They gave Jacob enough rope to hang himself in social situations and then set the blame squarely on his shoulders. And now, after all that work to shoehorn him into an ordinary school setting, he's in a courtroom peppered with accommodations for his special needs. His only chance at acquittal hinges on his diagnosis on the spectrum. To insist that he's just like anyone else, at this moment, would be a sure prison sentence. After years of refusing to make excuses for Jacob's Asperger's, this is the only chance he has. And suddenly, I'm running, as if my life depends on it. It's after 2 a.m. and the pizza parlor is dark. The closed sign flipped on the door. But in the tiny window above, a light is burning. I open the door to the narrow staircase that leads to the law office, climb the steps, knock. Oliver answers, dressed in sweats and a t-shirt that has an old, faded picture of a man with furry, ursine arms. "Support the Second Amendment," it reads. His eyes are bloodshot, and he has ink stains on his hands. "Emma?" he says. "Is everything okay?" "No," I say, pushing past him. There are takeout containers on the floor, and an empty 2-liter jug of Mountain Dew lies on its side. Thor, the dog, is asleep with his chin notched over the green plastic bottle. "No, everything's not okay." I face him again, my voice catching. "It's 2 in the morning. I'm in my pajamas. I just ran here." "You ran here?" And my son's going to prison, so no, Oliver, everything's not okay. Jacob's going to get acquitted. Oliver, I say, tell me the truth. He moves a stack of papers off the couch and sits down heavily. You know why I'm awake at 2 a.m? I'm trying to write my opening statement. Want to hear what I've got so far? He lifts up the paper he's holding. Ladies and gentlemen, Jacob Hunt is... He stops. Is what? I don't know, Oliver says. He crumples it into a ball, and I know he's thinking of Jacob's meltdown just like I am. I don't fucking know. Jacob Hunt is saddled with an attorney who should have stayed a farrier, that's what. I shouldn't have said yes to you. I shouldn't have gone to the police station. I should have given you the name of some guy who can do criminal law in his sleep, instead of pretending a novice like me might have half a chance of pulling this off. If this is your way of trying to make me feel better, you're doing a really lousy job, I tell him. I told you I suck at this. Well, at least now you're being honest. I sit down beside him on the couch. You want honest? Oliver says. I have no idea that jury is going to buy the defense. I'm scared. Of losing, of the judge laughing me out of court as a total sham. I'm scared all the time, I admit. Everyone thinks I'm the mother who never gives up, that I'd drag Jacob back from the edge of hell 100 times if I had to. But some mornings I just want to pull the covers over my head and stay in bed. Most mornings I want to do that, Oliver says, and I swallow a smile. We're leaning against the back of the couch. The blue light from the street lamps outside turns us both into ghosts. We aren't in this world anymore, just haunting its edges. You want to hear something really sad? I whisper. You're my best friend. You're right. That is really sad. Oliver grins. That's not what I meant. Are we still playing True Confessions? He asks. Is that what we're doing? He reaches toward me and rubs a strand of my hair between his fingers. I think you're beautiful, Oliver says. Inside and out. He leans forward the tiniest bit and breathes in, closing his eyes, before he lets the hair fall back against my cheek. I feel it inside me, as if I've been shocked. I don't pull away. I don't want to pull away. I don't know what to say, I stammer. Oliver's eyes light up. Of all the gin joints in all the towns in all the world, she walks into mine, he quotes. He moves slowly, so that I know what's coming, and kisses me. I should be with Jacob. By court order, I'm already breaking rules. What's one more? His teeth catch my lip. He tastes like sugar. Jelly beans, he murmurs against my ear. My biggest vice, after this. I tangle my hands in his hair. It's thick and golden, wild. Oliver, I gasp as he slides his hands under my camisole. His fingers span my ribs. I'm pretty sure you're not supposed to sleep with your clients. You're not my client, he says, and I'm not nearly as attracted to Jacob. He peels back the cardigan I'm wearing. My skin burns. I cannot remember the last time someone treated me as if I were the hallowed museum piece that he had received permission to touch. Somehow, we've inched ourselves down onto the couch. My head falls to the side, along with my best intentions, when his mouth closes over my breast. I find myself staring directly into Thor's eyes. The dog. Oliver lifts his head. Jesus, he says, and he stands up, grabbing Thor like a football in one arm. You've got lousy timing. He opens a closet and tosses a handful of milk bones on a pillow inside, then sets Thor down and closes the door. When he turns around again, I draw in my breath. Somehow his t-shirt has gotten lost between the cushions. His shoulders are wide and strong, his waist tapered, his sweats riding low. He has the easy beauty of someone young enough to dismiss how lucky he is to look like that without trying. Me, on the other hand, I'm lying on a ratty couch in a cramped room with a jealous dog in the nearby closet, with freckles and wrinkles and 15 more pounds than I ought to have and... Don't, Oliver says softly, as I pull the edges of my cardigan together again. He sits down on the edge of the couch beside me. Or I will have to kill Thor. Oliver, you could have any girl you want, any girl your age. You know what young wine is? Grape juice. There are some things worth the wait. That argument would have been much more convincing coming from someone who hadn't just finished off a trough of Mountain Dew. He kisses me again. Shut the hell up, Emma, he says amiably, and he puts his hands over mine, where they rest on the edges of my sweater. It's been forever. The words are quiet, hidden against his shoulder. That's because, Oliver says, you were waiting for me. He slips aside the sweater again and kisses my collarbone. Emma, is everything okay? He asks for the second time this night. Except this time, I say yes. I should have gotten rid of the king-size bed. There is something horribly depressing about it, only having to tuck in half the sheets each morning, because the other side always remains pristine. I never cross the Mason-Dixon line of my marriage and sleep every now and then on Henry's side. I've left it for him, for whoever might take his place. That turned out to be Theo during thunderstorms when he was afraid. Or Jacob when he was sick and I wanted to keep an eye on him. I told myself that I liked the extra space anyway, that I deserved to spread out if I wanted to, even though I have always slept curled on my side like a fiddlehead fern. Which is why, I suppose, it feels perfect when the pink fingers of the morning stroke the sheet that Oliver's tossed over us sometime in the night. And I realize that he's curled around me, a comma, his knees tucked up behind mine and his arm tied around my waist. I shift, but instead of letting me go, Oliver tightens his grasp. What time is it? He murmurs. 5:30. I turn in his embrace so that I'm facing him. There's stubble on his cheeks and his chin. Oliver, listen. His eyes squint open. No. No, you're not going to listen, or no, you're not Oliver. I'm not going to listen, he replies. It wasn't a mistake, and it wasn't just a one-time what-the-hell night. And if you keep fighting me on this, I'll make sure you read the fine print on the retainer you signed, which very clearly states that the attorney's sexual services are included in the fee. I was going to tell you to come over for breakfast, I say dryly. Oliver blinks at me. Oh. It's Thursday, Brown Day. Gluten-free bagels?
I prefer everything, he answers, and then he blushes. But I guess I made that fairly obvious last night.
I used to wake up in the morning and lie in bed for 30 seconds, when whatever I had dreamed might still be possible, before I remembered that I had to get up and make whatever breakfast fit the color code, and wonder whether we would survive the day without some schedule change or noise or social conundrum triggering a meltdown. I had 30 seconds when the future was something I anticipated, not feared. I wrap my arms around Oliver's neck and kiss him. Even knowing that, in 4.5 hours, this trial will start again. Even knowing that I have to hurry home before Jacob realizes I'm missing. Even knowing that I have likely made a mess of things by doing what I've done, I've figured out a way to stretch those 30 seconds of bliss into one long, lovely moment. 3 letters. A place where hope was found. Joy.